Well, the story of Blacks in British Columbia is one of the more compelling stories of immigrants seeking a homeland and finding a homeland, partly as refugees, which I'll explain, partly as opportunists looking for a new land and a new place, and partly in relationship to wandering characteristics that they'd been obliged to take upon themselves to seek out homelands and places for habitation for their families, including schooling and church and employment, of course, that was related to the diaspora out of Africa, which had begun as early as the 1600s, made a powerful impact in the United States in 1619, continues to be a dominant force in American politics to this very day. Now, leaving that aside, the first Black influence that comes to the British Columbia circumstance comes from California. This was typical of what was happening in any event, because the gold rush of California had such a profound impact upon the search for gold in British Columbia and in Haida Gwaii. And in the year 1862, to cut to the specifics of it, a vessel called the Commodore arrived in Victoria Harbor, jammed to the gills, so to speak, with gold seekers. And on board were either 600 or perhaps as many as 800 Blacks. Their circumstances in coming from California was partly related to the difficulties that they had been facing in California. Now, California was not a slave-holding state. Indeed, California local politics had fought against that, against those people who wanted slave owners in California. And there were many other states in the Union that fought this great battle about whether or not Blacks would be slaves or not. And in Kansas, there was a famous big fight over this called Leading Kansas. Leaving that aside, Blacks were to some degree refugees, and they were looking for opportunities. Whether there had been pressures or rules and regulations against them in the California gold fields is something that I'm not familiar with, but I'm sure has been studied. But in this case, arriving in British Columbia was like arriving on an uncontested beach head. First of all, the governor of Vancouver Island, Sir James Douglas, was himself Black. He has been described as a West Indian Creole, also sometimes is mentioned as a mulatto, having a mulatto mother. But leaving that aside, he is one in British Columbia of the strong examples of Black leadership in our province. Secondly, and more importantly than that, slavery was not allowed. It was illegal in British territories around the world, and that had been brought into effect in two ways. Like, first of all, 1807, the abolition of the slave trade in British ships. Secondly, in 1834, the rules and regulations against plantation slavery. The plantation owners were compensated. The Blacks, in many cases, were given indentured employment thereafter. Others became free in the sense that they could migrate and move. And it's in this latter category that we find this cluster of people who go first to California, and then not all together, in groups, family associations, these newcomers of color come to Vancouver Island and to Victoria in the Commodore. Almost immediately, they're bound for the Fraser River Gold Rush. The gold has been discovered in the lower Fraser and in the lower portions of the Thompson River. Many of them who came to Victoria were not inclined to become gold seekers. Many of them, therefore, desired to become merchants and shopkeepers and to engage in day labor. And there was always a need for that in a young city. And when I was a young boy here in Victoria, there were many persons, Black persons, who were engaged as day laborers, and others as business owners. So there is a legacy there. In Victoria, just to speak of that, many of them found their way into the Congregational Church. The Congregational Church is a following church of Calvin. It's where my own family comes from, so I know a bit about it. And it had taken in Huguenots and dissenters. These were people who did not agree with the 39 Articles, would not subscribe to the 39 Articles. So they were naturally excluded from becoming officers in the Royal Navy or clergymen in the Anglican Church. But these people, the Blacks frequently found themselves in dissenting churches. That's why so many of them are Black to this very day. And Baptist Church, excuse me, are Baptist to this day. And indeed, Baptists and faith communities are representations of Black solidarity and Black community activity. You see this in American films, you see this in Canadian films, you see this in Canadian life, and in Ontario and in Montreal particularly. There are large Black congregations. And they're not Church of England. They're not Catholic either. They're independent, mainly Baptist-aligned churches. So the Baptists and the Wesleyans and the Congregationalists had offered freedom to these people. These are the white persons who'd given support to the Underground Railway, and in Ontario, Major Simcoe, the governor, had outlawed slavery very early. So that meant, and even before the British had done it themselves, so that meant that Ontario became a heartland of for the from Black settlement. Returning to Vancouver Island, there was one outstanding individual whose details I have here, and I'd like to bring them to your attention. His name is Mifflin, M-I-F-F-L-I-N, Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S, and he's an entrepreneur. There's a beautiful portrait, a head and shoulders portrait of him in the BC Archives, and he looks every inch the gentleman entrepreneur of his age, with a white wingback collar and a beautiful tie and a lovely suit. Now, he wrote, after he came to Victoria in 1854, with this part of this group of American Blacks who were saddened by the racial discriminations that they were facing in the United States. He wrote this: "I cannot describe with what joy we hailed the opportunity to enjoy that liberty under the British Lion, denied to us beneath the pinions of the American Eagle." Repeat it. "I cannot describe with what joy we hailed the opportunity to enjoy that liberty under the British Lion, denied to us beneath the pinions of the American Eagle." So, British Columbia, Vancouver Island, Salt Spring Island, the mainland. These were places of freedom. They were places where places of refuge. And this was the leader of this group and spokesperson of this group, who helped organize the Victoria Pioneer Rifles, which is an independent small militia group. And there's a wonderful photograph of these chaps all dressed in their uniforms with their rifles. And then in 1866, he won election to town council, became head of the financial committee, and served as acting mayor. So this is a major achievement. In Matthew McPhee's book, Matthew McPhee wrote a wonderful travel book about Vancouver Island and British Columbia, published in 1865. It's sort of an emigrant's guide, but he was also a Congregationalist minister, and he described how the blacks in the Congregational Church all sat at the back. That invites the question as to whether or not there was a segregation within the church, their separate pews or not. It also invites the question as to whether or not blacks wanted to stay together. It also invites the question as to whether or not they wanted to mix with whites, or whether they found it that there was safety in numbers, that their pattern, their social pattern, was to seek through the homogeneity of their color, was to seek a social binding. I often see these things misrepresented, and people jumping to the assumption, well, they're all sitting in the back because it's like being in the back of the bus and they can't sit in the front seats. Maybe it was a matter of choice. I invite you to consider that. And maybe there's more research to be done there that we can find it, or maybe we will never be able to find. Anyway, like many a good Victoria person, he decides after becoming a major figure in city council, he decides to go to Salt Spring Island. Why not? And he was a pro-Confederation delegate to the Yale Convention. He went up to the Queen Charlotte Islands in 1869-70 on an expedition that was looking for a coal mine. And then he decided that there wasn't enough adventure left in British Columbia. So, my dear, he actually decides that it's time to go back to the States. It's become, since the end of the Civil War, it's become a little more, the Civil War in the United States has become a little more attractive for blacks, and there's more opportunity. So he goes to Arkansas, and there he becomes a lawyer. And it's a matter of record that he was the first black person to become an elected judge in the United States. So here's a success story. One would like to know why he didn't stay in British Columbia. Maybe family ties at home in Arkansas or some other place in the South. Maybe it was because of Southern Reconstruction that they needed a judge there, and he was such an excellent person. Now, his story has been written by a guy called Killam in a book called Go Do Some Good Thing. That's a famous BC book, Go Do Some Good Thing. But it's also an introduction to Black life in British Columbia in these early days. Believe me, there was a much more ostracization against Chinese coming in at this period of time than there were blacks. And one of the reasons for this, of course, is the blacks were Christian on the one hand, right? That's an obvious introduction to many others who are Christian. And the second thing is that they spoke English. And that was a force for integration and acceptance. I should not fail to mention that what you might call the first Blacks coming to British Columbia had been the Kanakas, or the Hawaiians, who'd come on various ships from the Sandwich or Hawaiian Islands in the era of the sea otter trade. And Kanakas were very powerful in Victoria at the time of the establishment of the fort. And indeed, one of the principal chiefs here was called King Freezy, and he was part indigenous, i.e. Indian, by technical terms, on the one hand, and secondly, on the other, had a Hawaiian or Kanaka background. So he has an indigenous name, but he's generally called King Freezy because of the Freezy hair that he had, which was apparently typical of these people at that time. There were a great number of Kanakas, Black Sandwich Islanders, let's put them there. But the Blacks that we're talking in Victoria in the building of the fort and afterwards as day laborers, but the Blacks that are mentioned here as the main point of our discussion are those that had come from California. And to make it a summary of the point, it's Mifflin Gibbs, the outstanding politician, businessman, and financier, and later lawyer, who is the key person. And I think it's important when we study our history that we try to identify some principal persons on which to tell our tale and identify our tale. Sad to say, I know nothing of his family, but that's another story for others to follow up. So it's a great story of individual activity, and it's a great story of Vancouver Island and British Columbia becoming a place of opportunity for these people. I'm not saying there wasn't segregation. I'm not saying there wasn't difficulties. I'm not saying there weren't hostilities. There were bound to be in interracial mixings at this period of time, as in our own times. But for Mifflin Gibbs, he is, in terms of Black History Month in February, he is the number one star. Intriguingly, so much attention is given to James Douglas, and rightly so. But it's Gibbs. Mifflin Wistar Gibbs. He was born on the 17th of April, 1923, in Philadelphia. And he died on the 11th of July, 1915, in Little Rock, Arkansas. He was born a free Black man, and then he went to California in the gold rush and then up to Victoria.
I gotta jump in for one second there. I think you said he was born in 1923.
I'll go back. I've got to close the door 18. Here. My puppy is raising hell.
Okay.
So Mifflin Wistar Gibbs, born 17 April 1823 in Philadelphia, dies 11 July 1915, Little Rock, Arkansas. Now, think of the long life that he had and all the adventures that he had. Born a free Black man with the horrors of slavery over his shoulder, coming all the way to Victoria, going to the gold rush and prospering here as a merchant, going to Salt Spring Island, discovering the joys of freedom under the British flag, and then later able to return to his native United States, which has gone through this tremendous transformation in consequence of the horrific Civil War. He's a powerful individual, and we wish we knew more about him, but we do know quite a bit. I think that's a wonderful way to start the story of Blacks in Canada. There are many, many chapters to be followed thereafter. It's known that there was a preliminary party that came to British Columbia or to Vancouver Island to seek out the possibilities of finding a new homeland here. That comes in advance of the major intake of 1858. Furthermore, what's the other point, Greg, you want to mention?
The returning after the gold rush died off and the economic conditions became difficult.
Yes. And also, typical of gold seekers, when the opportunities of the gold rush diminished, and they diminished very, very quickly here, there wasn't a lot of sustaining power for a number of reasons. Partly it became more hydraulic mining than individual panning for gold, but that's another story for another day. Many of these adventurers and gold seekers returned to other places, the United States in particular, in San Francisco and Portland. So that would be the case with some of the Blacks that had come in that initial party.